So here we are, ready to start with some of the typical technical issues, but they're fairly minor. I think we're okay. So welcome, everybody. Happy Mother's Day. I appreciate your coming in on a holiday. You're participating. It's Mother's Day in America. I don't know if that applies in the rest. I doubt that it applies in the rest of the world, but it's fine if you want to take a moment to think kind thoughts about your mother. Okay. So we are in week two of session 11. We're spending these 5 weeks and the 6 weeks that follow on knowledge. And what we've been doing in last week's class and this week's class is, in a sense, starting at the beginning. That's maybe not the right way to describe it. The fact is, and let's see if I can get this image a little... The fact is that we started, in a sense, at the end. That may not be quite right, but we started with a strong invocation of the possibilities for a knowledge in which we are really completely in tune with what the world presents, and we feel most alive. And the word that we used to talk about that last week was we talked about reality being its own witness. When we're operating in that way, we don't need to go anywhere or do anything. Knowledge is kind of built in, you could say, to our experience. So that is I wouldn't quite call it the goal, but it's pointing us in a good direction if we think that way. Now, in today's reading, and I warned you about this in the orientation, the word witness is used very differently. And that's actually a little unusual in the TSK books. There's a very strong carryover from one book to the next. Words tend to be used the same way. There are small shifts. In this case, I think you could make the argument that we're still talking about the witness in the same way. But what happens is that we feel that we have to do something with this witness. We have to make the witness talk. in the reading for last week, the witness was the witness simply in being present. Our own experience was its own witness. But now we can't rest with that, and we'll take a look at why. So what happens is we have to make the witness tell us what's going on, right? So the reason for that is that there is this fundamental not knowing. You know, this is the very beginning of the reading for this week. In that first paragraph, he says, well, we have to look at this fundamental not knowing. And why we speak of not knowing, we'll see in a little while. But there is this sense that we are not able to make sense of our experience, and we need to understand it, and so we turn to the witness. But it's not, now it's the witness that we're going to cognize, we're going to make this witness, or we're going to insist that the witness cognize and verify. That's at the top of page 103. Says, we set up these structures, this is at the bottom of 102, and we make sense of things, and that's our job. Right? As it says about six lines up, it says, as human beings, we take it as our task to make sense of what's going on. So we're not content, you might say, to just let things go on. This is a little bit like the image that's used in Zen sometimes of selling water by the river, right? The image, the suggestion is that all the water you could possibly ever want is in the river. But somebody comes along and sets up a little store and sells you water at the side of the river. And knowledge is kind of like that. All the knowledge that we need, all the knowledge that, let's say, the whole range of knowing and the knowable and knowingness and all of those different ways of talking about knowledge, it's all immediately available. But we feel that we have to do something special to get some knowledge. We have to set up a shop, and we have to buy the knowledge that's being offered on the side of the river instead of just being in the river. And there's an image by William James that I've talked about in the past that's very much like that, where he's talking about psychologists, and he said psychologists are like people who take a bucket and they're going to study water, and so they take a bucket and they fill their bucket from the river with water, and then they go back to the laboratory and study what's in the bucket instead of just lying face down in the river, you know. So this is the basic problem. We feel that we have to make sense out of things, and so we call on the witness to do that. We set up these structures, and then at the very top of 103, as he says, we need to authenticate those structures, and so we call on a witness to cognize and verify what is happening. That's the witness we're looking at today. And can you make that, you know, can you say that that witness is related to the fundamental witness of presence that we talked about last week? Yes, I think you can, but it's not essential. Just don't get confused between the two. That's really all I'm saying. So I'm going to go back for a moment to the witness we looked at last week. The quality of that witness, what Rinpoche really emphasized in the beginning of the of that chapter that we read for last week from Love of Knowledge, is the aliveness of the witness. You know, everything is intense. Everything is has kind of a radiance to it, and we've all had that experience. He says, you know, we all have a sense of what that's like. And that dynamic is its own witness, and that dynamic is what we lose when we make the witness testify. Right? And the question, of course, is why do we do that? And there's a very interesting description of that, the first full paragraph on page 103. What Rinpoche is doing here is, you could say, speaking from the point of view of the self. And the self says, well, this is my job. I have to make sense out of things. And you, because it has that job, it can't just let experience be present. And in fact, it sees that as a big threat. You have to do something about it. So let's look at that paragraph on page 103. It says, the witness makes it possible for us to take a stand in time. And this positioning is fundamental for making sense of the flow of events. So we take a stand. And of course, that's problematic from a TSK point of view. You know, by taking a stand, we've already cut ourselves off from the dynamic of time. And we can only do that because we're relying on this witness who's going to testify as to what's going on. And he says, you know, we think that we have to do that because we have to make sense out of experience. We can't just let experience be experience. We have to make sense out of it. And that goes right back then into the notion of telling a story about what's happening or a narrative, right? We relying on the knowledge that the witness testifies to. So let's go back to that paragraph. He says, we have to do this positioning, you know. To see this, he says, I'm still reading, imagine that the arising of appearance into form was a single act, that appearance and knowledge of appearance were given together with no act of witnessing. And he puts the word of in quotation marks there because, in fact, there wouldn't be an of. Right? Knowledge and appearance would arise together. There wouldn't be any separate act, which is what the of is pointing to. So imagine that that happened. There's no witnessing, he says. The present as such would give way to the ongoing interaction of past and future, leaving us no opportunity to take hold of what is happening. And again, that's what we see as our job. We have to take hold of what's happening and make sense out of it. And if you look at the word comprehend, which he uses later, we have to comprehend what's happening. The word comprehend, if you look at its Latin roots, basically means to take hold. So we have to take hold of things, and then we can comprehend them. For in taking hold, we comprehend them. That's what the witness lets us do. If we didn't do that, we would only have the ongoing interaction of past and future. Now, it's interesting what he's doing in this paragraph, because he's kind of presenting the TSK vision, but he's presenting it from the point of view of the self, which says, oh, terrible. This is awful. I can't make sense out of things. I can't comprehend them. There's no knowledge. And you know, from a TSK vision, from the vision of TSK, you'd say, well, that not knowing in the comprehension sense is actually the same as a deeper knowing. But the self looks at it and says, no, this is a disaster. So the ongoing interaction of past and future, we can't take hold. Then he says, swept along in time's dynamic, we would never have the chance to proclaim our presence in the world. And that's what matters to us, right? The substantial reality that we insist on in the claim, here I am. Nor could knowledge in its ordinary sense arise at all, with no possibility to identify, react, or affirm, we could never say, this is real, this is true. So, the TSK vision is exactly saying there's this interplay of past and future, and there isn't any particular stand that we take. We don't have to insist on being present. We don't have to insist on the here I am. But the self says, yes, we do. Otherwise, I've lost my connection to my own being or my insistence that I exist. And actually, someone told me a nice story the other day, which was exactly about this. I didn't even realize it at the time, but then I thought later, this is exactly the point. They were talking about being at a little family get-together, and their two-year-old nephew came running up to his father and said, Daddy, I'm here. And he kept saying this, and his father was trying to have a conversation. And so he said, go tell your mother that you're here. So he went running off saying, Mommy, I'm here. Mommy, I'm here. And that's this here I am. You could even imagine, let's say, that that young child is has just discovered the here I am, right? So we all at some point discover the here I am, and then that becomes the truth of our being, and then we have to insist on taking a stand, and we can't really take the stand. We have to have the witness take the stand and testify as to what's going on. And that's what he goes on to say then in the next paragraph. The witness is the one who brings the present into focus and creates a single-minded kind of clarity. It assigns identities, it traces their interaction. In other words, we get lower-level knowledge. Now, does that mean you have to give up? I mean, assuming we say, okay, I understand that's a problem. Does that mean you have to give up lower-level knowledge? Well, no, but you have to give up a commitment to it. You have to give up the claim to that. The self, that's what the self does. It goes about making claims. It goes about taking a position. It goes about saying, here I am. And That, too, is a manifestation of knowledge. We won't look at it right now, but maybe at the end today, if we have time, right at the very end of the chapter on 114 or 113, right at the end of the chapter, Rinpoche says, you know, that's okay. That's one way in which knowledge manifests, is the way that the witness testifies. And that, too, is an expression of knowledge. But we take that as being the whole of knowledge, or it never even occurs to us that there's anything other than knowledge. So we have we make a commitment that cuts us off from the rest of knowledge. So you remember at the very beginning of the chapter, Rinpoche says, we want to investigate the fundamental not knowing that's characteristic of our experience, and that not knowing is equivalent to the knowing of the witness. That's the fundamental point, you could say, that's being made here in this chapter, and we want to go on to explore it. Now, let's talk for a moment about a question that people often ask, I think, or I actually haven't had people ask me this very much, but I always assume it's in people's minds. And I think it has come up sometimes. And that is to say, if we could let go of this commitment to the self and immerse ourselves in the dynamic of time, which is what Rinpoche is really saying here, well, we would be like babies and animals who don't try to figure out who they are, who don't ask questions, who don't assert their own existence. They're just tuned into the dynamic of time. And it may be, I mean, I don't know. I don't remember being a baby, and I don't remember being an animal, so I can't say. But it may be that we have a connection there. But I don't think it's fair or accurate to say that what we're trying to do is become more childlike. Because children also take a stand, you know, and animals also take a stand. Their stand is, you know, it's based on very simple stories like I want and I need. Right? We have the opportunity to tell much more expansive stories. Now, I realize I'd kind of forgotten all about the chat box, so many people have already said things. That's great, but now I have to catch up. So let me stop and catch up with experience. So Ron asks, the witness move is co-emergent with the owner of experience? That's a question. And I would say basically, I mean, I think there are certain things that Rinpoche talks about in different ways that are closely tied to each other. Being the owner of experience, it's not exactly the witness who owns experience. The witness just testifies. And you remember in Love of Knowledge, actually, Rinpoche does talk about the different roles that the self plays. So that would be a place to look. But yes, you can't have ownership of experience until you've named it. Then you can claim it. And the witness does the naming and the owner does the claiming. Is the witness one facet of the self? Yes, exactly. And actually, I hadn't thought of it until now, but that chapter where Rinpoche talks about the five different aspects of the self, that would be the place to look at that. And Ken says, the stand, taking a stand, equals a position, a frozenness. Yes, absolutely. So you impose meaning. You remember that nice quote from Love of Knowledge, the self... I may not have the order right. The self posits a situation, so the positing is already taking a position, imposes meaning, and I'm missing one right now, but it's okay. We are constantly positioning ourselves, taking positions, and by doing that, we freeze the dynamic of time. And Siddhi says, at this junction of getting hold, duality gets born. That's right. It's I said before that when Rinpoche put single quote marks around the of, because there isn't really an of if you're in the dynamic of time. The of implies a duality. You know, I have knowledge of my situation. So there, that's the duality, and then I comprehend it. So it's this paradox that's really, in some ways, at the heart of the TSK understanding of knowledge, is that it's exactly when we insist on knowing, like through comprehension, that through taking hold, through taking a position, and imposing meaning, and positing a situation, those are the three. It's exactly when we do that that we commit ourselves to not knowing. Because it's exactly then that the, as you say, the duality gets born. Okay. So Ron says, I see the self seeking itself as testifying that it is real, like it has to constantly pinch itself to tell itself, yes, I'm here, I'm real. The dynamic feels like a constant threat to its employment. Yeah, that's right. So employment is an interesting word here. I said before that it's like the self's job to make meaning, to impose meaning, and the text actually says that's our task. But yeah, it's like we've been hired to do this, and the witness has been hired, I guess, to give the testimony that's going to make it possible. And that's because as soon as the self emerges, it's got this problem because it's kind of born into this chaotic flow of time. And it's exactly opposed to that, and it's got to make sense out of it. So there's this big job that the self has to do. That's right. John says, asks, if the witness is sourced in something vaster, is the witness this vastness, or is it the smaller aspect that does the testifying? How could it be both? Which I'm hearing in the language of our last class. Is the witness the presence, or is the witness the interpreter? Well, that's exactly the distinction that I was trying to point to before. I think in the last class, we were talking about witness as presence. Presence is its own witness. You could say you don't need any other witness. But the self decides that it does need another witness. That's exactly what the self does. And you could say that's where the self gets things wrong. And so it insists on a certain kind of knowledge, which is inevitably going to be lower level knowledge. Okay, Sudhi asks, or says, both, it's so deeply habitual, this looking for the knowledge of the witness, right, that the witness testifies to. It's so deeply habitual that it needs a new habit to be born via meditation? Question mark. And Ron comments on that, yes, but the witness can turn meditation into just another narrative. I think it depends on what you mean by meditation. And then Ron says, but I'm not sure if he's still referring to the same point, it's not a dumbing down of knowledge. Well, Rinpoche actually says something about meditation later on, so let me see if I can find it. I wasn't going to go there right now, but I think it's a good idea. Basically, here it is. It's on page 104. So we're busy insisting on this one way of knowing, this comprehending. And that's what we looked at in that paragraph on page 103. And we think we have to do that because otherwise we're going to be in deep trouble because everything's just going to overwhelm us, which is kind of true because, you know, it's sort of like saying, well, if you're in the river and it's this surging river, a very powerful river, well, it can just flatten you against the rocks and crush you, you know. But being, if presence is its own witness, then it's not like you're in the river, it's more like you are the river. I wouldn't want to insist on that image, but I think it kind of works. So, is meditation a way of being the river instead of being in the river? Or is it the river, you know, being the water in the river instead of the water that's being sold at the side of the river? Maybe. It's possible. I think when Ron says it kind of depends on what you mean by meditation, that's probably right. What Rinpoche says here about what we do and where he brings up meditation is at the bottom of page 104. So he's talking about setting ourselves up. We take a position, and that's a position not only in space, but a position in time. And once we've taken that position, this is in the second full paragraph on 104, we're limited to that position. We can only see or engage or know what's happening at that point in time. You could certainly also say a point in space, but the whole discussion in this chapter is about time. So he's saying, having situated ourselves at a unique point in time, we cannot leave that point. We're limited by the position that we take. Okay? And then he goes on and he says, this limitation operates whether the present point is a single instant or is more extensive. So you know, you might say, well, okay, there's a limitation in my ordinary understanding, and Sudhi is commenting on this, I see, in the chat box. She says, well, the type of meditation I'm talking about, she doesn't say that, but I'm adding that, the type of meditation I'm talking about is a meditation that touches the timeless. So Rinpoche says here, okay, there's this limitation in time, but maybe we could open that up. Maybe we could move toward the timeless. And he says, there may be ways to expand our present awareness in time. For example, by cultivating intuition or vision, deepening concentration, or developing a meditative stillness. And then he also brings up another possibility. We could be more accurate, but we don't have to go to that one. So he points towards the possibility of meditative stillness or concentration as a way of expanding our presence in time. And he says, still, even if we do this, we'll ultimately come up against the boundary established by our present presence. Right? We won't be able to grasp the whole of knowledge because we're still committed to this idea of grasping. So you could say, well, no, I'll let go. I think that's fine. It may well be that there are forms of meditation in which you can do that and move toward the timeless, as Sudhi says. And Ken brings it into a space context here in his comment in the chat box. He says, allow the witness to be transparent. Space is the allowing, non-dimensional presence. So, yeah, it seems like you could think about this in terms of time or space, or you could think about it in terms of some traditional meditation practices. I may have mentioned last week, I can't remember that whether I did, that in the Hindu tradition especially, there's this whole idea of witness consciousness. I can't really go into that. It's not, I think, what's being talked about here in this chapter, because in the end, I think what Rinpoche is saying in the paragraph we just looked at is, as long as you take any kind of position, even if it's the sort of zero position of the witness, which may be how you could think about witness consciousness, you will come up against the limit. It's only if you let go completely. Right? So we have two words here. Sudhi says timeless and Ken says transparent. And I think in terms of TSK, yes, those are both at least moving in the direction that TSK wants to point us towards, which is where there is no positioning at all. Right? There's no imposing meaning. There's an allowing. And that then leads you to a kind of aliveness. Okay. So there is the chapter moves on to really look at how the self's way of knowing is cut off from this deeper knowledge. And specifically what it does, and I'm looking now at pages 106, really, let's see, I think starting at 106, yeah, the bottom of 106, he says, this doesn't work. The whole claim that the witness makes to be able to testify, to be able to give us accurate knowledge, it won't work. Logically, it doesn't make sense. And he says at the bottom of 106, he says, it's not as though proving that, if we could absolutely prove that, It's not, that wouldn't necessarily help, because we have this very strong habit. Somebody referred to habits before. Rinpoche doesn't use the word habit, but he says it's so firmly established that even if we can show logically that the witness could never do its job, that will not make us give up our commitment to a witness-centered way of knowing. But still, he says, it may help loosen things up. It's helpful. And so then he spends the next several pages of the chapter showing you that the whole idea of a witness doesn't really make sense, and it has to do with the fact that the act of witnessing itself takes time. There's more. I'm not going to try to go into that. I'm going to kind of skip over that. You can certainly go back and look at it. What I want to do instead is turn to what happens at the end of that discussion. He comes back again on page 109 to the idea, or to the point, that the witness has to freeze the dynamic of time. Let's see, Hayward says, while it's difficult to not take a position, perhaps we can see position is being assumed and not take it so seriously as the truth. Well, yes, you know, there is, and I already mentioned how at the end of the chapter, Rinpoche says, you know, the fact that the self goes around taking positions is not in itself, it's hard to say this quite right. I mean, he says it very nicely, so I should just quote the chapter, but I won't. What you can do is let the self's way of knowing continue to be available as a manifestation of a deeper knowledge. And I think that's very similar to what Hayward is saying here. That possibility is there. And Sudhi agrees. That's a huge freedom. In other words, you know, Ken talked about allowing the witness to be transparent. That's, I think, very similar. And Hayward says, you can see that the position being assumed is we don't have to take it so seriously. It's just that a position is being assumed. Someone somewhere is assuming a position. Okay. Okay. And then Michael asks, is the witness both awareness and the content of awareness? As if the wit mistakes its witticisms for the root of intelligence. Well, we'd have to look at that, your language, kind of carefully. But I think in principle, I'm not sure. One way of thinking about the witness is to say, you know, if you could kind of get beyond what the witness testifies to simply presence, that presence would also be an awareness. But as soon as the witness testifies to a particular content, then it also testifies to the one who knows that content. So the witness always gives you this structure, and the witness then identifies itself as the I, right, as the self. So the witness is awareness, but in this kind of limited way. Okay, so the witness kind of feels that it has to do that. And on page 109, Rinpoche says, yes, the witness freezes the dynamic of time, and we would certainly say that that's a big problem. But the witness doesn't think it is. The witness thinks it's just fine, you know. And the witness says, well, that's my job. That's what I'm doing. So we judge things in terms of my goals, my intentions, my experience and understanding. And then Rinpoche says, this whole structure is a kind of bluff, which is very interesting. We tell this story. The witness testifies, and it's a story, and it's all about me and my goals and intentions and experience and understanding and all of that. And Rinpoche says, "Yeah, but it's just an interpretation, and it can't found itself." And he says, "You know, it's true enough on the ordinary level, the conventional level, and." We use that way of knowing to get around in the world, but somehow we would like to stay open to the possibility that it is not that's not the truth of the way things are. It's what the witness is saying. Right? And Ken comments, all the my's don't establish anything, including itself. That's right. That's what we would like to be able to connect to. Now, what I would like to do is, let's see if I can find it here. Yeah. I'd like to look at the negative side for a moment in our practice. I'd like to have us do some practice now, and it'll take up. Well, I was going to try to do it a little longer than our usual practice, but we'll do it for about 5 minutes. If you look at page 110, the third full paragraph, Rinpoche has said, you know, the witness is always testifying to the substance of what it identifies. Right? At the bottom of the second paragraph, it says, dismissing the freedom of the zeroless, and some of your comments have touched on that. So, unwilling to stay with, you could say, the freedom of the zeroless, the witness makes the substance of the recorded the unvoiced theme of all its testimony. In other words, the witness depends on being able to say, this is the way it is. And if we didn't make that commitment, if we were willing to acknowledge that nothing gets established, then the witness would really pretty much fall silent. Okay? We'd like to do that. But we're not quite ready, and at least that's where we're headed, you could say. That's what we're aiming to investigate as we go on here in this session. But right now we want to look at or get more familiar with the substance of the witness. And this third paragraph I think is helpful here. He says, this is the structure, what we've just been talking about, that is insupportable, not only as a matter of logic, but for the consequences it brings. And that's an interesting move. That's where we want to go. In other words, he's been talking about logic and how it doesn't make sense logically that the witness can take that position. But instead of trying to move from the lack of logic and thereby be able to undermine the claims of the witness, here he shifts and he says, we could move if we really are willing to investigate the consequences of taking this position. And then he describes that in just this one sentence. When we accept the testimony of the witness, we can only find in favor of frustration and not knowing. Now this word find in, you know, throughout this chapter he's been playing with the language of the courtroom. Because after all, the witness takes the stand in a court. I'm using American legal language here. The witness takes the stand and testifies, and then the judge or the jury, whoever is supposed to establish the truth of what's being said, takes in the testimony of the witness and finds in favor of a certain position. And here he's saying, the only position we can find in favor of is frustration and not knowing, repetition and pain. So that's the consequence. That's the consequence of accepting the testimony of the witness, and in particular, accepting the claim of the witness to be telling you the substance of what's so. Sudhi says, logic is in the realm of duality and positioning. Yes, it is. That's right. And that's why it doesn't seem to have power to do very much. It's, you know, the... I won't go any further into that. So we're going to look at this other approach for just a few minutes here. What I want you to do for about 5 minutes now, and we won't have much time to talk about it, but maybe online you could investigate some more. What I want you to do is look within experience for this quality of frustration or not knowing, which he describes to here. He describes here repetition, pain. You might also talk about agitation or being alone, you know, the sense of being isolated, there's a characteristic flavor. You know, the world that the witness testifies to has these qualities of frustration, of not knowing, of repetition, of pain, isolation. It's not a very happy place. You know, in the Buddhist tradition, you talk about samsara. We're not coming from a Buddhist context, but it's, you know, there's this flavor that comes up, and you could say, well, why is that? Well, it's partly, and we can't go into this right now, we've looked at it in different ways, because, you know, the witness is making some claims that just aren't justified. And so, of course, there's a kind of distortion, and you could say the frustration and the not knowing and the repetition and the pain are all related to that. So let's take a few minutes, and so this is kind of a subtle exercise, that's why I wanted to do it a little longer, but we'll just do it for a few minutes and see if anything comes up. What we're looking for here is that if you just let experience be experience, there is constant witnessing going on. You know, we're always kind of looking around and saying, this is this, and this is this, and that's that, and I'm here, and I'm reacting. All of those kinds of things are constantly being testified to. And what we're asking here is, or what we're looking for here, is the quality, the consequence of that, in terms of the kind of emotional context, this frustration and not knowing and repetition and pain, the things that get pointed out here. So see if you can find that. It's kind of subtle because we think of it as reality. We think of it as the way it is. But there's a flavor to it. And if we could touch that flavor, it would help point us in a different direction. That's what's being suggested here. Okay. Let's practice for a few minutes. Okay, so let's come back together. I don't know if that was enough time for to get anywhere with this. I think, in my experience, it requires a little more reflection. But maybe somebody would... I'd like to make a comment Okay, Eliana says, if I bring awareness inward, and thank you for bringing that idea in, because Rinpoche talks at the end of this chapter about turning knowledge inward, which does relate. If I bring awareness inward, I can see a holding back together with the frustration. So seeing it, I can release it. Turning inward makes it possible to fuse the witness with space. Well, that's a very nice description, and of course connected to things that Rinpoche has writes about in the TSK vision. But I don't think this phrase comes up exactly, and I like it. Fusing the witness. Remember, we're not necessarily trying to get rid of the witness, right? He says, let me look at that passage right now that I mentioned before. He talks about a way of knowing the witness and the inwardness, turning inward, right? He says it has, I'm on 113, he says it has nothing to do with subjectivity, but it doesn't mean that the witness collapses into chaos. Instead, it is the substantiality of the witness that gives way. And your description, Eliana, of fusing the witness with space is a very nice way of saying that. I want to say one thing, and then I'll look at a couple of the other comments that people have made. what I want to say is, think back again to this question about what about meditation, or what about vision or intuition? Those are some of the examples Rinpoche mentions. You can see that if there's this fundamental sense of frustration and repetition and barriers in our ordinary way of being, that it would be very attractive to be able to open up our usual limitations. But what Rinpoche has said is that in the end, unless you're willing or able to question the substantiality of the witness, just changing what it is that the witness testifies to, even making it into a God realm, to use a Buddhist term, that's not going to be enough. Okay. Ken says, arising witness fails to note its arising. Not knowing prevails. Yes, that's good. I mean, you raise a really interesting point that Rinpoche doesn't exactly talk about in this chapter, I don't think, which is, so how is it that the witness arises? If you don't notice that, maybe you've bought into something that could be questioned. And not knowing prevails. And Sudhi says, when I remember that whatever shows up in awareness is the awareness taking that form, then it is all apparent that there is no duality of I and the appearance. But often I forget this amazing truth. So yes, we are always left with this question, which is really in some ways the guiding question for us. Why is it that we forget this amazing truth? How is it that activating the vision, even when we see some of the wonderful promise that it offers, how is it that we forget, or we don't activate, or we don't allow? It's still the ongoing question. And you know, I think when we finish this program, it will still be a question. It won't be completely clear. Okay. We are over our limit. Thank you, everybody. You're always very patient. I suggest, and maybe I'll even make it part of the walk around, that you continue to look at this question. Can you find within your experience, and it's going to be linked to all these my claims, right? Can you find within your experience, which is always centered on the I, the consequence of insisting on the truth of the I? Okay. There are a couple more comments, and I don't want to close people off. So there's actually several comments, so I will at least reference them. So Michael says, I felt the desire for a comfortable nest in which to rest. Too bad that the nests we build soon feel like a cage. The desire to be able to fly seems to follow from the limitations we build around us. It's a welcome prospect that the witness we've confined, and who confines us, I'd say, has a natural affinity with the aliveness that is never inherently stuck in our constructs. Yeah, I think you're right. It's not as though we have to somehow do away with the witness. That would be very problematic. But what we need to find is what it is within the witness that celebrates a deeper aliveness or awareness. Hayward says he's going to be away. Karen says, if we always could see our reality as a bluff, right, thanks for pointing back to that term, we don't have to believe it. Being in contact with frustration and pain, it's hard to see the bluff. Yeah, so why is it that we want to look at the frustration and the pain? Well, maybe within that frustration and pain, you could say, we experience some of the not knowing, because after all, we don't want to feel frustration and pain, but we don't know what to do about it. So finding the not knowing within the consequences of accepting the testimony of the witness, that's where we want to be. And the other thing, of course, about experiencing the frustration and pain is that it does give us a motivation. Does it have to be like this? Ron says he likes my magic trick analogy. This is something that Ron and I corresponded about a while ago, so I'm not going to try to mention it right now, but he kind of draws the conclusion. We think we're going to be more present or meditate or focus or whatever the method might be, but since we don't know what to look for, we still get tricked. Well, I can make the point. The point is that we can watch a magician who's doing a trick, and we are being very, very intent, but we look in the wrong place, or the magician encourages us to look in the wrong place, so we still miss the trick. And yes, that's right, the trick gets tricked. And Philip said, my feeling was that the billion barriers shivered a little. Nice. And showed their softness. And I trembled very slightly at the prospect that being is really much more, much freer than I usually live it. And perhaps this freedom is freely available and very near. Well, that's very nicely put, Philip, and I will leave it at that. Yeah, I just will leave it at that. We will talk next week. Enjoy your week and to continue to work with this practice. Okay. Goodbye.